mended even in death, lest the living begin to think themselves equal, get uppity, out of their place, and threaten the myths that the upper caste kept telling itself and the world. Imagine Dr. Jeff Guskey, a physician who, decades later, took an interest in the case, told the Army Times in 2018. How powerful this would have been in the American press if word got out that there were two black soldiers who died in this ambush and were both nominated for the Medal of Honor. A generation later, during the Second World War, there was continued resistance to the lowest caste rising from its assigned place, even in the most mundane of endeavors. One day in the spring of 1942, white army officers happened to assign black soldiers to direct traffic in Lincolnton, Georgia, as an army convoy passed through. It caused an uproar in town. The sight of black men in uniform standing at an intersection halting white motorists apparently sent some residents over the edge, wrote the historian Jason Morgan Ward. After the war ended, in February 1946, Sergeant Isaac Woodard Jr. was riding a Greyhound bus home to North Carolina from Augusta, Georgia, where he had been honorably discharged, having served in the Pacific Theater. At a stop along the way, Woodard asked the bus driver if he could step off the bus to relieve himself. The driver told him to sit down, that he didn't have time to wait. Woodard stood up to the driver and told him, "I am a man, just like you." Woodard had been out of the country and away from Jim Crow for 3 years, had served his country and taken on a degree of assertiveness and self-confidence that most Southern whites were not accustomed to, nor prepared to accept, in the words of the Southern author and judge, Richard Gergel. The driver backed down for the time being, told him to go ahead then and hurry back. But at the next stop, outside Aiken, South Carolina, the bus driver notified the police. There, the police chief arrested Woodard on charges of disorderly conduct. At the bus stop and later in jail, the police chief beat him and jabbed his eyes with a billy club, blinding him. The next day, a local judge found him guilty as charged, and though he asked to see a doctor, the authorities did not get him one for several more days. By the time he was finally transferred to an army hospital, it was too late to save his eyesight. He was blind for the rest of his life. The NAACP brought the case to the attention of President Harry S. Truman, a Midwestern moderate who was incensed to learn that authorities in South Carolina had taken no action in the maiming of an American soldier. He ordered the Justice Department to investigate based on the fact that Woodard was in uniform at the time he was beaten and that the initial assault occurred at a bus stop on federal property. But the federal trial ran into caste obstructions in South Carolina. The local prosecutor relied solely on the testimony of the bus driver who had called the police. The defense attorney hurled racial epithets in open court at the blinded sergeant. And when the all-white jury returned a not guilty verdict for the police chief, the courtroom broke out in cheers. It had been revealed during the trial that Woodard had apparently said yes instead of yes, sir, to the police chief during the arrest. This, combined with the elevated position his uniform conveyed, was seen as reason enough for punishment in the caste system. After the trial, the police chief who had admitted to jabbing Woodard in the eyes went free. Woodard went north to New York as part of the Great Migration. The northern white judge assigned to the case lamented, "I was shocked by the hypocrisy of my government." The message was clear to those whose lives depended on staying in their place or appearing to. If a Negro rises, he will be careful not to become conspicuous, lest he be accused of putting on airs and thus arouse resentment, wrote the ethnographer Bertram Shrieka. Experience or example has taught him that competition and jealousy from the lower classes of whites often form an almost unsurpassable obstacle to his progress. It was largely Black efforts to rise beyond their station that set off the backlash of lynchings and massacres after Reconstruction following the Civil War, that sparked the founding of the Ku Klux Klan and the imposition of Jim Crow laws to keep the lowest caste in its place. A white mob massacred some 60 Black people in Ocoee, Florida, on Election Day in 1920, burning Black homes and businesses to the ground, lynching and castrating Black men, and driving the remaining Black population out of town after a Black man tried to vote. The historian Paul Ortiz has called the Ocoee riot the single bloodiest election day in modern American history. It occurred amid a wave of anti-Black pogroms in more than a dozen American cities, from East St. Louis to Chicago to Baltimore, as Black Southerners arrived north during the Great Migration, and many tried to make their claims to citizenship after risking their lives in the Great War. One thing these rampages had in common: the mobs tended to go after the most prosperous in the lowest caste, those who might have managed to surpass even some people in the dominant caste. In the 1921 riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a mob leveled the section of town that was called Black Wall Street, owing to the Black banking, insurance, and other businesses clustered together and surrounded by well-kept brick homes that signaled prosperity. These were burned to the ground and never recovered. Decades before, in the early 1890s, a Black grocery and a white grocery sat across the street from each other at an intersection just outside Memphis, Tennessee. The Black store, known as People's Grocery, was a cooperative that was thriving even as the walls of Jim Crow closed in. Its owner, Thomas H. Moss, was an upright figure in a three-piece suit and bow tie with a side part in his close-cropped hair, who did double duty delivering mail and running the grocery. Both he and his grocery store drew the resentment of his white competitor. One day, two boys, one Black and one white, were playing marbles in front of People's Grocery and got into an argument. The white boy's father began to thrash the Black boy, at which point two clerks from the Black grocery ran out to rescue him. A crowd gathered, and tensions rose. Seizing on the discord and angered by the competition from the Black store to begin with, the white grocer, William Barrett, showed up at People's Grocery looking for one of the store clerks who had intervened in the fracas. But the clerk on duty, Calvin McDowell, refused him any information. The white grocer struck McDowell with a pistol for his perceived insolence. McDowell managed to wrestle the gun from the white grocer and fired, barely missing him. Under the protocols of the caste system, it was the Black store clerk who was arrested. Though he was released, the caste system had only begun to stir. The Black owner, Thomas Moss, tried to prepare for it. He stationed several Black men to guard the grocery. On March 5, 1892, six white men stormed People's Grocery. The Black grocer and his supporters fired upon the intruders, wounding two of them. The white men happened to have been the sheriff and five men he had just deputized. After the shooting, 100 more whites were deputized to hunt down the Black store owner and other Black men he knew. The three Black storekeepers, the owner Moss, and the two clerks, McDowell and Will Stewart, were arrested. In the early morning hours of March 9, 1892, a mob stormed the jail and tortured and lynched all three men. The next day, a white mob ransacked People's Grocery, and within months, Moss's white competitor bought the store for pennies on the dollar. One of Moss's dear friends was the journalist Ida B. Wells, and this lynching is what set her on her lifelong mission to awaken the country to the terror of lynching. A finer, cleaner man than he never walked the streets of Memphis, Wells wrote. He was murdered with no more consideration than a dog. The colored people feel that every white man in Memphis who consented in his death is as guilty as those who fired the guns which took his life. The irony of the quest of the lowest caste is that it is the very uprightness embodied by Moss, attested to by Wells, and applauded when shown by most every other group, that incites the greatest backlash. The effort to escape stigma is what can trigger the punishment. Moss was murdered for running a better business than his white competitor, wrote Nathaniel C. Ball, a historian at the Hooks Institute at the University of Memphis. McDowell for forgetting his place in the hierarchy in the white world he lived in, and Stewart for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. The lowest caste was to remain in its place like an ill-fitting suit that must constantly be altered, seams and darts resewn to fit the requirements of the upper caste, going back to the enslavers who resented displays of industriousness and intellect in the people they saw themselves as owning. When slaves earned money, they became vain and arrogant, wrote the historian Kenneth Stamp, and felt more independent. They were not to be credited for their ideas or innovations, even at the risk of progress for everyone. Crediting them would undermine the pretext for their enslavement, meaning their presumed inferiority in anything other than servitude. In the summer of 1721, an epidemic of smallpox, one of the deadliest afflictions of the era, besieged the city of Boston. It sent stricken people into quarantine, red flags signaling to all who might pass, "God have mercy on this house." Cotton Mather was a Puritan minister and lay scientist in Boston and had come into possession of an African man named Onesimus. The enslaved African told of a procedure he had undergone back in his homeland that protected him from this illness. People in West Africa had discovered that they could fend off contagions by inoculating themselves with a specimen of fluid from an infected person. Mather was intrigued by the idea Onesimus described. He researched it and decided to call it variolation. It would become the precursor to immunization and the holy grail of smallpox prevention for Western doctors and scientists, wrote the medical ethicist and author Harriet A. Washington. During the 1721 outbreak, Mather tried to persuade Bostonians to protect themselves with this revolutionary method, but did not anticipate the resistance and rage, the horrid clamor, that arose from Bostonians. The idea sounded outlandish to them. They feared it could spread smallpox all the more, and they also wanted nothing to do with a practice that had come from Africa and had been suggested by an African slave. Physicians dismissed the procedure out of hand and resented being told by a gaggle of ministers that Africans had devised the panacea they had long sought, Washington wrote. Rage turned to violence when someone hurled a lighted grenade into Mather's house. Mather escaped serious injury, but wrote that he could see no difference between adopting the African solution for smallpox and using the Native Americans' antidote for snake venom, which the colonists had readily taken up. Only one physician, Zabdiel Boylston, was willing to try the new method. He inoculated his son and the enslaved people he owned. In the end, the epidemic would wipe out more than 14% of Boston's population. But of the 240 people that Boylston had inoculated, only 6 died, 1 in 40, as against 1 in 7 people who forewent inoculation. By 1750, vaccinations based on the method introduced by Onesimus would be standard practice in Massachusetts and later in the rest of the country. What is clear is that the knowledge he passed on saved hundreds of lives and led to the eventual eradication of smallpox, wrote the author Aaron Blakemore. It remains the only infectious disease to have been entirely wiped out. For his contribution to science, Onesimus does not appear even to have fully won his freedom. What little that is known is that Mather grew sour on him, and Onesimus managed to buy partial freedom by paying Mather money toward the purchase of another slave. He had gone well beyond what would have been expected of a man of the lowest caste, and, as often happens, does not appear to have reaped the rewards for a role that was beyond his station. Instead, the rewards and privileges flowed from upholding the caste order. Doing so could boost the prospects of those who knew to stay in their place. The more conspicuous, the better. 2 centuries after Onesimus's day, the Jim Crow regime would make a single exception to its iron law of segregation between blacks and whites. It was for black maids who had shown themselves sufficiently faithful to be entrusted with the care of white children. These women alone could ride in the whites-only section of a train or bus if they were out taking care of a white child. This exception served several purposes. It enshrined the white child as the ticket to a first-class seat for a black person. It reinforced the servile role, the natural place of the subordinate caste. It elevated the black nursemaid by fiat of the dominant caste. It made domestics superior to even the likes of the great orator Frederick Douglass, who was once reduced to sitting on top of cargo on a train journey. It protected the children of the dominant caste from enduring for a single trip the taint and discomforts of the colored car. And it reminded everyone in the subordinated caste that they would only rise with the permission of the dominant caste and on its terms, and only as long as they kept to the role assigned them. They were to be given no quarter, no latitude to imagine themselves in any place other than the bottom rung. From Reconstruction to the Civil Rights era, Southern school boards spent as little as 1/10 the money on black schools as for white schools, openly starving them of resources that might afford them a chance to compete on level ground. School terms for black students were made shorter by months, giving them less time in class and more time in the field for the enrichment of the ruling caste. In hiring black teachers for segregated schools during Jim Crow, a leading Southern official, Hoke Smith, made a deliberate decision. When 2 Negro teachers applied to a school, to take the less competent. It was a nakedly creative way to cripple black prospects for achievement. It put black children under the instruction of the least qualified teachers. It passed over the brightest, most accomplished applicants, in fact, punished excellence, while elevating the mediocre in a purposeful distortion of meritocracy. All of this created dissension in the lower caste over the patent unfairness and worked to crush the ambitions of those with the most talent. In these and other ways, the caste system trained the people in the lowest caste that the only way to survive was to play the comforting role of servile incompetent. The caste system all but ensured black failure by preempting success. In a caste system, there can be little allowance for the disfavored caste to appear equal, much less superior at some human endeavor. In the early years of the Third Reich, The Nazis made a point of excluding Jews from any position or circumstance in which they might outshine Aryans. This extended to classrooms in which the Berlin Gestapo went to the trouble of ordering that everything must be done to put an end to the appearance that Aryan students are receiving assistance from Jews in preparing their exams. These were the ways that, irrespective of the natural range of intelligence and talent arising in any human subset, the people in the dominant caste were artificially propped up as superior in all things, a setup for disillusionment not of their own making. If one of the requirements of a hierarchy is that the lowest caste must remain the scapegoat on the bottom, the culture works to keep it that way by playing up the stereotypes that affirm their lowliness and minimizing indications to the contrary. In America, news outlets feed audiences a diet of inner-city crime and poverty so out of proportion to the numbers that they distort perceptions of African Americans and of societal issues as a whole. Little more than 1 in 5 African Americans, 22%, are poor, and they make up just over a quarter of poor people in America at 27%. But a 2017 study by Travis Dixon at the University of Illinois found that African Americans account for 59% of the poor people depicted in the news. White families make up 2/3 of America's poor at 66%, but account for only 17% of poor people depicted in the news. These generations-old distortions shape popular sentiment. A political scientist at Yale, Martin Gillens, found in a 1994 study that 55% of Americans believed that all poor people in America were black. Thus, a majority have come to see black as a synonym for poor, a stigmatizing distortion in a country that glorifies affluence. Like poverty, crime, too, receives coverage out of proportion to the numbers. Crimes involving a black suspect and a white victim make up 42% of the crimes reported on television news, even though crimes with white victims and black suspects make up a minority of crimes at 10%, according to the Sentencing Project, an advocate for criminal justice reform. For generations, the culture has decried the alarming rate of births among black teenagers, often accompanied by depictions of welfare dependency, even though the majority of teenage mothers of all races are unmarried and likely to require help. But one might not know from news coverage that the rate of black teenagers giving birth has plummeted in recent decades, from 118 per 1,000 black teenagers in 1991 to 28 per 1,000 in 2017. According to a 2019 analysis by the nonprofit research institute Child Trends, this should be considered great news for society. The turnabout in birth rates for black and Latina teenagers has helped bring the overall teenage pregnancy rate to the lowest levels recorded in the modern era. Yet what little media coverage there has been has tended to revert to familiar caste tropes about unemployment and poverty, language of the 1990s, rather than looking into the reasons for the historic decline. These numbers are clearly telling us something, and they do not fit caste assumptions. The long-term downward trends, the researchers wrote, may reflect that teenagers are increasingly likely to delay sex and, if sexually active, to use contraception more carefully, meaning that black and Latina teenagers are taking precautions at a rate that is bringing them closer to the mainstream, an outcome contrary to societal expectations and thus largely disregarded. The investment in the established hierarchy runs sufficiently deep that people in the dominant caste have historically been willing to forego conveniences to themselves to keep the fruits of citizenship within their own caste. After the Supreme Court outlawed segregation in public schools in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, the white-run school board in Prince Edward County, Virginia, delayed integrating as long as it could, and then shut down the school system entirely rather than allow black students into classrooms with white students. The county had no public schools for 5 years, from 1959 to 1964, forcing parents of both races to find alternatives for their children. Local whites diverted government funds to private academies for white students, while black parents, whose tax dollars were now going to the white students, had to make do on their own. Around the same time, civil rights legislation outlawed segregation in public facilities, and in response, cities in the South closed, auctioned off, or poured concrete into their whites-only pools so that nobody could swim, rather than sharing the water with black people. But those in the dominant caste had the means and resources acquired over generations of collective income and wealth disparities to build private pools behind gated communities for themselves and their children, leaving the lowest caste locked out again. It is in these ways that a caste system shapeshifts and protects its beneficiaries. A workaround emerges, provisions are made, and the hierarchy remains intact, even in the face of challenges from the highest authority in the land. This is how a caste system, it seems, manages always to prevail. In-group, out-group tensions remain a feature of American life. When black teenagers attended a pool party in a predominantly white gated community in McKinney, Texas in 2015, white residents called the police on them for trespassing. Afterward, as shown in a video that drew international attention, an officer who responded to the call yanked a 15-year-old girl from the sidewalk, slammed her to the ground face down, and pinned her with his full weight. Here was a grown man with his knees bearing down on her slight, bikini-clad frame as she sobbed, helpless, beneath him. When black boys instinctively rushed to help her, the officer pointed his gun at them and they backed away, the full power of the state treating them not as children, but as threats to society. It was a scene that would be hard to imagine occurring with a young girl from the same caste, the dominant caste, as the officer. Within days, the officer resigned, but the incident demonstrated the depth of assumptions about who belongs where in a caste society, and the instantaneous walls erected and punishments meted out for breaching those boundaries even in our era. Chapter 16. Last Place Anxiety, Packed in a Flooding Basement. Caste puts the richest and most powerful of the dominant caste at a remove, in the penthouse of a mythical high-rise, and everyone else in descending order on the floors beneath them. It consigns people in the subordinate caste to the basement, amid the flaws in the foundation and the cracks in the stonework that it appears others choose not to see. When those in the basement begin rising to the floors above them, surveillance begins. The whole building is threatened. Thus, caste can pit the basement dwellers against themselves in a flooding basement, creating an illusion, a panic even, that their only competition is one another. It can lead those down under to absorb into their identities the conditions of their entrapment and to do whatever it takes to distinguish themselves as superior to others in their group, to be first among the lowest. The stigmatized stratify their own, wrote the anthropologist J. Lorand Mottori, because no one wants to be in last place. Over the generations, they learn to rank themselves by their proximity to the random traits associated with the dominant caste. Historically, the caste system has granted privileges to some in the subordinated group, with the use of a toxic tool of caste known as colorism. Among marginalized Americans, the closer they have been to the dominant caste in skin color and in hair and facial features, the higher on the scale they have generally ranked, the women in particular, and the more value attached to them even by those whose appearance is further from the caste-driven ideal. This distortion in human value is especially insidious in America, owing to the historic means by which most African Americans acquired their range in color and facial features: the rape and sexual abuse of enslaved African women at the hands of their masters and of other men in the dominant caste over the centuries. With few other outlets for control and power, people on the bottom rung may put down others of their own caste to lift themselves up in the eyes of the dominant. They may feel more deeply wounded and deprived personally when someone of their shared lower rank rises or pushes past them than when the already chosen move ahead. When someone from the already favored group moves up, it can seem preordained, in line with expectations, more easily accepted because this is how things have always been. Those in the dominant caste were above ground anyway. The rise of a favored person can seem less a commentary on you or your own deficiencies than a reflection of the way the world is. Conspicuously outperforming one's fellows is sometimes resented, as it makes people who are already feeling inferior feel even more inferior, Matori wrote. Honor is a zero-sum game, with particularly intense implications for the discredited, because there is so little honor to go around. The caste system thrives on dissension and inequality, envy and false rivalries that build up in a world of perceived scarcity. As people elbow for position, the greatest tensions arise between those adjacent to one another, up and down the ladder. In India, the uppermost castes have historically at times found themselves rubbing against one another. They even quarreled over such petty questions as to who should salute first, observed Bin Rao Ambedkar, as to who should give way first, the Brahmins or the Kshatriyas, when the two met in the street. If there are anxieties at the top, so much more so at the bottom. The caste system has historically rewarded snitches and sellouts among the lowest caste, as with the enforcers in the concentration camps of the Third Reich and the slave drivers on southern plantations. This was such a common device that in America, there are several names for such a person, among them Uncle Tom or HNIC, short for Head Negro in Charge. People in the lowest caste came to resent these stooges of the caste system as much as, if not more than they resented, the dominant caste itself. Even as others in the lowest caste try to escape the basement, those left behind can tug at the ones trying to rise. Marginalized people across the world, including African Americans, call this phenomenon crabs in a barrel. Many of the slave rebellions or the later attempts at unionizing African American laborers in the South were thwarted because of this phenomenon: people subverting those who tried to get out. The spies paid with an extra peck of privilege for forewarning the dominant caste of unrest. These behaviors unwittingly work to maintain the hierarchy that those betraying their brethren are seeking to escape. But this universal impulse may not always be caused by rank envy. A group already under siege may feel that the team just cannot afford losing any member, wrote Sudipta Sarangi, an Indian specialist in organizational management. If a certain member of the group starts climbing up by doing better in life, the sheer fear of that individual's exit pushes everyone to pull him down. Success in the American caste system requires some level of skill at decoding the pre-existing order and responding to its dictates. The caste system instructs us all as to whose lives and opinions should bear the most weight and take precedence in most any encounter. One of its teachers is the criminal justice system, which descends from the criminal codes of the slavery era. There we learn, for instance, that it is the race of the victim rather than just the perpetrator that is the greatest predictor of who gets the death penalty in the United States. The acclaimed legal justice advocate Brian Stevenson observed, citing a study on death penalty cases. Offenders in Georgia were 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim was white than if the victim was black. These studies were replicated in every other state where studies about race and the death penalty took place. The lesson teaches everyone, for instance, whose lives are considered expendable and whose are sacrosanct. It forces everyone to tithe to whatever degree to the supremacy of the ruling caste in order to flourish. Upon entry to the American caste system, immigrants learn to distance themselves from those in the basement, lest they land there themselves. Though it was the protest movements of the subordinated caste that helped open the door to non-white immigrants in 1965, immigrants of color, like immigrants throughout American history, faced the dilemma of adhering to the unwritten rules of caste. They faced the painful dilemma of either rejecting the lowest caste of indigenous African Americans or making common cause with those who fought so that they could enter the country to begin with. But caste inverts the path to acceptance in America for people of African descent. Immigrants from Europe in the previous century were often quick to shed their names and drop the accents and folk ways of the old country. They played down their ethnicity to gain admission to the dominant caste. Black immigrants discover that because they look like the people consigned to the lowest caste, the caste system rewards them for doing the opposite of the Europeans. While white immigrants stand to gain status by becoming Americans, wrote the sociologist Philip Kazanitz, by assimilating into the higher status group, black immigrants may actually lose social status if they lose their cultural distinctiveness. Many recent African immigrants are better educated, better traveled than many Americans, may be fluent in multiple languages, and do not wish to be demoted to the lowest caste in their adopted homeland. The caste system encourages black immigrants to do everything they can to build distance between themselves and the subordinated caste they might be taken for. Like everyone else, they are exposed to the corrosive stereotypes of African Americans and may work to make sure that people know that they are not of that group but are Jamaican or Grenadian or Ghanaian. A Caribbean immigrant told Kazanitz, "Since I have been here, I have always recognized that this is a racist country, and I've made every effort not to lose my accent." It is a clever self-perpetuating tool of the caste system to keep those at the bottom divided in a manufactured fight to avoid last place. This has led to occasional friction between people descended from Africans who arrived in America at different points in our history. Some immigrants from the Caribbean and Africa, like their predecessors from other parts of the world, may show a wariness of African Americans, warn their children not to act like African Americans, or not to bring one home to date or marry. In so doing, they may fall into the trap of trying to prove not that the stereotype is false, but that they do not fit the lie. Up and down the hierarchy, Ambedkar noted, each caste takes its pride and its consolation in the fact that in the scale of castes, it is above some other caste. Try as it may to entice newcomers to take sides in upholding the hierarchy, the caste system fails to reach some people. Some children of immigrants from the Caribbean, people like Eric Holder, Colin Powell, Malcolm X, Shirley Chisholm, and Stokely Carmichael, among many others, have shared in the common plight of those in the lowest caste, become advocates for justice, and transcended these divisions for the greater good. Caste helps explain the otherwise illogical phenomenon of African Americans or women or other marginalized people who manage to rise to authority only to reject or diminish their own. Caught in a system that grants them little true power or authority, they may bend to the will of caste and put down their own if they wish to rise or to be accepted or merely to survive in the hierarchy. They learn that they may not be held accountable because of the low status of those they betray or neglect. Many cases of mistreatment of people in the lowest caste occur at the hands of those of their same caste, as in the case of Freddie Gray, who died of spinal injuries at the hands of police officers in Baltimore. Gray was handcuffed in the back of a police van but not secured with safety belts, according to court testimony. The van swerved and curved, knocking Gray around the cargo area, handcuffed and unable to keep himself from crashing into the interior walls of the van. Three of the officers involved were Black, including the driver of the van. This combination of factors allowed society to explain away Gray's death as surely having nothing to do with race, when in fact, it was likely caste at work. All of these officers were either acquitted or had their charges dropped. It is in keeping with caste protocols that of the few officers who have been prosecuted for police brutality in recent high-profile cases, a notable number of them were men of color. A Japanese-American officer in Oklahoma, a Chinese-American officer in New York City, and a Muslim-American officer in Minneapolis. These are cases in which men of color pay the price for what upper caste men often have gotten away with. This phenomenon runs across levels of marginalization. The supervisor of the officers at the chokehold death of Eric Garner was a Black woman. The people hardest on women employees can sometimes be women supervisors under pressure from and vying for the approval of male bosses in a male-dominated hierarchy in which fewer women are allowed to rise. Each of these cases presents a complicated story that presumably dismisses race or sex as a factor, but one that makes perfect sense, and maybe only makes sense, when seen through the lens of a caste system. The enforcers of caste come in every color, creed, and gender. One does not have to be in the dominant caste to do its bidding. In fact, the most potent instrument of the caste system is a sentinel at every rung, whose identity forswears any accusation of discrimination and helps keep the caste system humming. Chapter 17. On the early front lines of caste. In the fall of 1933, a distinguished Black couple, newly returned from their studies in Europe, headed south from Virginia in the direction of Nashville, and then, with both dread and anticipation, passed a symbolic iron curtain into the heart of Jim Crow, Mississippi. They were anthropologists embarking on a perilous 2-year study of the social hierarchy of the South. They were entering hostile and alien territory where they would have to learn to sublimate their upright bearing and submit to the humiliations of the social order, knowing that any slip-up could cost them their lives. They could not reveal the true nature of their mission at their final destination of Natchez, Mississippi. They would have to watch their every step in a world that preferred to keep its feudal conventions to itself and to keep people who looked like them in their place. They were driving headlong into a region where a black person was lynched every 4 days for some breach, large or small, of those conventions. They would soon discover that just weeks before their arrival, a black man had been lynched in the county next to Natchez under accusation of raping a white woman that even many local whites did not believe. Allison Davis was an impeccably tailored academic with the sculpted, square-jawed face of a film star, and his wife Elizabeth was a model of refinement. But their path had been a twisting obstacle course. Just the previous spring, they had cut short their advanced studies at the University of Berlin and fled Germany when Hitler took power. They'd seen the Nazis burn books and jail teachers, and this gave him new insight into the nature of hate, and combined with the burdens he bore in his own country, further inspired him to examine injustice. Davis was a young anthropologist with 2 degrees from Harvard University and a wealth of experience abroad. But once in Mississippi, he could not in any way act like it. He would have to conceal his inner self to survive. The couple had chosen to make the personal sacrifice for the greater good of documenting the structure of human division, a mission that would practically render them undercover agents. Urbane and bespectacled though he was, he decided it best to keep a gun in the car to protect himself and his wife if it came to it. In Natchez, they would be joining the other half of their team, a white couple named Burley and Mary Gardner, 2 other Harvard anthropologists who, in keeping with the plan, had preceded the Davises to Mississippi. The mission was quietly revolutionary. Together, they would embed themselves in a closed and isolated southern town from both sides of the caste divide. Coming from the north, neither couple could fully know what they were getting themselves into. This was in the depths of the Jim Crow caste system, and they would find their every move dictated by the very phenomenon that they were studying. This would be among the first studies of its kind and a groundbreaking experiment in interracial scholarship. They would have to plan every detail of their interaction with the local people and come up with plausible reasons for the 4 of them to be together in this alien landscape. Given the dangers, they would not be able to tell the local people the full intention of their project, that they were seeking to infiltrate the white and black worlds to accurately render how caste, class, and race operated in the region. The 2 couples were to report back to a senior professor who was overseeing the project from Cambridge. The pioneering anthropologist W. Lloyd Warner anticipated the dangers the team would face and went to Natchez himself ahead of the 2 couples to scout out the area and to prepare the town for their arrival. Warner met with the mayor and law enforcement officials and with editors of the local newspaper before leaving the team on its own. He told town officials that they had chosen Natchez to represent a typical southern town and that the researchers would be collecting data to compare it with a town in the north. This was not altogether untrue. Warner had completed research on social stratification in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and could find the comparison useful. The officials in Natchez were delighted to share the history of their town with the white husband and wife team. But it was harder for the team to come up with a credible reason for African-American scholars to come into town doing research. They made the decision to tell the locals that the black researchers were there to study the black church, a safe enough subject for the town fathers to accept. as a measure of how far ahead of society the researchers were and of the proficiency of Alison Davis, it was he, the black anthropologist, who was chosen to lead the team on the ground in Natchez. They were two different castes studying caste in the belly of the caste system. In order for the mission to work, the white couple went in first to get established before the black couple showed up. The gardeners rented rooms in an old country mansion as their base of operations and began gaining acceptance in Natchez society. But they had to give more forethought into where the Davises would live. The mansion was isolated, and the Davises would be uncomfortably, perhaps dangerously conspicuous in that rural setting. Finding housing for them was a challenge in a region where most African Americans were sharecroppers living in lean-to cabins. The team finally moved the project into the town itself, and the Davises rented rooms from a black doctor who opened the way to the town's few black elites. The couples soon found themselves embedded in their respective and separate castes, but that restricted them in other ways. The team needed to study the layers within each caste, the elite and the lowly. But the social hierarchy drew such stark lines that even within one caste, fraternizing with those not seen as on one's level invited scrutiny and potential ostracism. To reach poor white residents, the lower class of the dominant caste, Mary Gardner took a position as a government caseworker in a New Deal program, which allowed her to meet poorer whites and to visit their homes. That was not an option available to Elizabeth Davis, as the Davises sought to meet with poorer black residents. At the time, few African American women were permitted to hold those government jobs in Mississippi, and the federal relief that Mary Gardner was in a position to extend to the whites she met was not then being extended to poor blacks in Mississippi. So Alison Davis sought to recruit a fifth researcher, St. Clair Drake, a former student of his who decades later would become a renowned scholar of mid-20th century life in Chicago. The northern-bred Drake was not keen on spending months or years in the Jim Crow South, where only a few years earlier, 9 young black men known as the Scottsboro Boys had been imprisoned in neighboring Alabama, accused of attacking 2 white women, who later recanted their stories. Davis convinced him of the transcendent purpose of the mission. "You can't really smash the system if you don't understand how it works," Davis told him. Drake agreed to come, and he spent his time with sharecroppers and domestics that the Davises, now seen as part of the sliver of upper-middle-class blacks in Natchez, no longer had readily explainable access to. They were all locked in the roles into which they had been accepted, having to do whatever their subcaste did or compromise their foothold in their research setting. Their lives depended upon obeying the rules they had come to study and proving themselves loyal to the caste to which they were ascribed. Mary Gardner, the white woman researcher, went so far as to climb into a hoop skirt and to serve as hostess at a mansion tour to which she had been invited. It was perilous to step out of character, perilous for the white couple to be seen as too closely aligned with the Davises, with whom, in that world, the dominant caste would have had minimal contact. Out in public, they had to remain in character at all times, with the Davises required to show deference to the Gardeners and never give the appearance that they were, in fact, friends and colleagues in the trenches. The two women found that they could not be seen together in public at all, had to conceal how well they knew each other. The caste system disallowing that kind of camaraderie between women of different castes. Their encounters were limited to an occasional chance meeting at the chain grocery store in the center of town, wrote David A. Varrell, Davis's biographer. There they exchanged only a polite, restrained greeting. Over time, the white researchers came to see firsthand the barriers that African Americans faced. Wherever they went, if they were together, there were no guarantees of food or restrooms for the Davises. Every move had to be thought out in advance with consideration of caste protocol. There were times when Gardner, the white researcher, had to request the bathroom key if Davis were to be allowed to use it. Davis was the leader of the team, but they could not let the locals know that. They had to keep to their caste performance. It was a revolutionary concept, this idea of an educated black man working with a white man in this way to begin with, a spectacle the likes of which the townspeople would never have seen before. They couldn't pretend that they weren't working together, but it was explained to them, and generally understood by others, that Allison was working for Burley. This was the only acceptable relationship between a white man and a Negro, Varrell wrote. Just to meet and discuss their findings required an elaborate choreography. They had no outside office and could not go to each other's homes without arousing suspicions or causing discomfort. It did not sit well with the caste system for a white person to visit a black person. So Gardner could not visit Davis. It would have been permissible, and in fact expected, for a subordinate caste person to go to the dominant caste person's location for the convenience of the upper caste person. But for purposes of morale and dignity, it would have been unacceptable for Davis, as the team leader, to walk through the back door of his colleague's home. It was not enough to say that Allison was working for Burley. Each of them was expected to behave strictly according to his caste role, Varrell wrote. So they created a protocol for themselves whenever they needed to meet. One would telephone the other to make an appointment. Davis would arrive at an agreed-upon corner. Gardner would pick him up, and they would drive to a rural back road to go over their work in the car without bringing undue attention to themselves. Even this, they knew, was a breach of the caste system, but it was their only option if they were to get their work done. Later, Gardner happened to learn that both the chief of police and the sheriff were informed of each meeting, Varrell wrote. The sheriff and police chief did not intervene, but it was so serious a violation that the sheriff felt compelled to keep tabs on the two men. This surveillance was a reminder that at any given moment, the authorities could shut down their project, or worse. The sheriff could seize their notes at any time, exposing the true nature of the larger study and destroying the data that they were gathering, Farrell wrote. To protect their research, they made frequent mailings to Warner back in Cambridge. But Allison had to be careful in doing so. Frequent mailings by a Negro, especially an educated Negro, would have aroused suspicion in the middle-aged, middle-class, white postal clerk, Farrell wrote. The whole Negro-white research, Warner once said, was delicate and filled with dynamite. In 1941, as the United States prepared to enter the Second World War, the Davis and Gardner team emerged with perhaps the most comprehensive study to date of the American caste system. The volume was 538 pages long and titled Deep South, a Social Anthropological Study of Caste and Class. It described the layers of social classes within the two major castes in America, white and black people. Davis and the Gardners determined that caste was the fundamental division in the Jim Crow town they studied, built on economic interdependence in which the caste system and the economic system reinforce each other. They documented the multiple rungs within the two castes, the layers of classes within each caste, the social control employed to keep the castes separate, and the slave-like conditions and power structure on the plantations in America as it approached the middle of the 20th century. They chronicled the rigid codes of conduct required to maintain the hierarchy. A black landlord, for instance, had to walk to the back door of his own building to collect the rent from his white tenants. The team described the terror campaign against the subordinate caste, the daily menace to the sharecroppers who were subject to ambush in the planters' whipping parties, and the risks to the Davises themselves as they documented the assaults on other African Americans. It had taken them 8 years to publish their findings, and even then, the researchers were bedeviled with setbacks and the disadvantages of both caste and timing in getting it out to the world. They'd begun the work in the midst of the Great Depression, and thus faced the ongoing challenge of financing a project that seemed risky from the start. 2 years in, with the Depression worsening and the project taking longer than expected, the Davises, who had borne the brunt of the humiliation that confronted their caste and with the least personal resources, found themselves so strapped for money that they had to take on teaching duties at Dillard University, an underfunded, historically black institution in New Orleans. There, Allison Davis was weighed down with a teaching load of 5 courses each semester while trying to complete the larger caste study. Worn down by the isolation and indignities, having to perform in character over the course of several years, he fell into a depression over their circumstances. At the same time, competition arrived on the scene. The Mississippi Delta got crowded with young social scientists investigating this feudal country within a country, as the Depression had raised interest in rural and southern poverty. And while the interracial Davis and Gardner team had spent far longer, years, in fact, living under the caste rules they were studying, 2 Yale anthropologists, both white and working in the same area in 2 separate studies, spent several months in Mississippi, and with their shorter timelines, were able to beat the Davises and the Gardners' more comprehensive study to publication. John Dollard of Yale spent 5 months in Indianola. Hortense Powdermaker, also of Yale, spent 9 months there in the 1932-33 school year and another 3 months in 1934. Dollard's 1937 book, Caste and Class in a Southern Town, was the first of the 3 major works to be published. It received wide acclaim and defined the emerging field. Dollard was hailed as a pioneer, while the Davises and the Gardners were still analyzing their volumes of data. Dollard acknowledged the limits of his work, conceded that, as a white Yankee in the Southern caste system, he ran headlong into caste taboos that restricted his access to African Americans. The local whites he needed to rely on couldn't understand why he would be interested in black residents. When he told some white residents of his plan to visit a black woman's home, he said he was ostracized from the town. Hortense Powdermaker's After Freedom, A Cultural Study in the Deep South, was published next in 1939. Both Dollard's and Powdermaker's books were met with spirited reviews and came to dominate the field of Southern caste scholarship. Even decades later, the journal American Anthropologist in 2004 described the 2 books as canonical, landmark studies, consigning the Davis and Gardner book to the footnotes. Deep South was published in 1941 and has long been overshadowed by the 2 earlier works produced by scholars from the dominant caste. The Davis and Gardner project seemed to meet the same fate of marginalization as the subordinate caste that they had studied. Neither Davis nor Gardner made the claim that the Indian caste system and the American one were identical. Yet criticism of the idea of caste in America followed a pattern in caste relations that the team documented in Mississippi. They found that African American workers trained in the subordinated behavior and perspective necessary to survive in a caste system, were more likely to show respect for people in the dominant caste and to disregard or feel freer to criticize those from their own subordinated caste. For a range of complex reasons, some leading African-American social scientists of the early to mid-20th century objected to Davis and others applying the notion of caste to the plight of African-Americans, even as they were living under one of the purest forms of it in American history. Restricted as they were, locked behind the walls of caste with no end in sight, they did not want to give credence to the possibility that the system might indeed be closed forever. If their status was seen as a fixed one, there might be no hope of rising above it. They were deep in a caste wilderness before Brown v. Board of Education, before the Montgomery bus boycott, before the 1963 March on Washington, and the civil rights legislation of the 1960s that would formally prohibit the caste restrictions they were then living under. In the middle of the 20th century, no one could have dreamt of a member of the subordinate caste sitting on the Supreme Court, becoming Secretary of State, being in the Oval Office as president, rather than as a butler. The lowest caste had yet to break free and disprove the assumptions of group inferiority that were the justification of the caste system, show that its members were as capable as anyone else in any endeavor, from singing Verdi at the Metropolitan to orbiting space to winning Nobel Prizes. These things were inconceivable because the caste system had disallowed any possibility of them. Thus, there was an understandable fear that invoking the fixed and formal millennia-long caste system of India could forestall the few hard-earned gains they had managed to achieve. Any success that Davis might see was itself a challenge to the caste system, and as one of the few African Americans given the chance to conduct this kind of research, he walked a narrower path, had put his life on the line in a way others had not, and was in line for more criticism than dominant caste researchers might receive. The white researchers who were published before Deep South had the chance to seize on the novelty of the idea, were more readily embraced by the mainstream, and accorded more authority due in part to their position in the dominant caste. Despite their immersion and mastery of the subject, Davis and Gardner fell under greater scrutiny and faced more obstacles just to complete their book. Publication was delayed in part because a leading black sociologist, Charles Johnson, trained in a different discipline, raised lengthy questions about the manuscript, which required Davis and Gardner to embark upon a significant revision. Davis, as lead researcher, was an easier target for criticism, particularly from peers in the subordinated caste who were under pressure to uphold the hierarchy if they wished to succeed and who would have been wary of calling into question the work of dominant caste scholars. The resistance to Davis's work inadvertently proved the very theories Davis had devoted his life to exposing. The concept of caste grew only more contentious as it was applied to the United States at mid-century. One leading sociologist, the Caribbean-born Oliver Cromwell Cox, assembled a cantankerous critique of this school of thought in his landmark 1948 book, Caste, Class, and Race, A Study in Social Dynamics. He devoted 100 pages to his reading of the Indian caste system, and later chapters to the differences between the hierarchies of the two countries. An underlying argument of his contrarian view was that the caste system in India was singular, because it was considered stable and unquestioned, because even the lowest castes embraced their degraded lot as the fate of the gods. The fact that Black Americans resisted their condition, both in slavery and afterward, and aspired to equality, was evidence to Cox that the term caste could not be applied to this country. If, for instance, the Negro-white relationship were a caste relationship, he wrote, Negroes would not be aspiring toward the upper social position occupied by whites. In India, however, caste barriers in the caste system are never challenged, he wrote in a bafflingly misguided observation. From his perspective, up and down the Indian caste system, regardless of his position in the society, a man's caste is sacred to him, and one caste does not dominate the other. Despite his brilliance, he disregarded both the injustices inflicted upon Dalits by castes that most certainly dominated them, and the basic human will to be free. And he overlooked the fiery resistance and leadership of Bhimrao Ambedkar and other Dalits who were challenging the caste system at the very moment of his writing. Before Cox's excoriation of the notion of caste, the findings of Davis and the Gardners got reinforcement from perhaps the most ambitious work ever attempted on race in America, the monumental two-volume American Dilemma, published in 1944. It was based on the research of a team of scholars, including Davis and his contemporary Johnson, and was overseen by the Swedish social economist Gunnar Myrdal. In this analysis of race, Myrdal described intergroup relations in the United States as a caste system, a term he returned to time and again. The caste system, Myrdal wrote, is upheld by its own inertia and by the superior caste's interest in upholding it. Davis would go to get a PhD in anthropology at the University of Chicago and join the faculty there, thus becoming the first Black tenured professor at a major white American university. But he would suffer additional indignities. Faculty colleagues openly debated whether he should be allowed to teach white students, and he was prohibited from eating in the faculty dining room for a time. Of the major scholars of the American South in the first half of the 20th